WNYC support comes from Holy Name Medical Center, recognized among the best hospitals in New Jersey by U.S. News & World Report. More at holyname.org. Empire State Development's Division of Tourism, promoting New York State as a leader in America's farm-to-table culinary revolution, from wines, craft beers and spirits, to maple and dairy products, to fresh fruits and vegetables. Information at iloveny.com. BAM, presenting Cider. Choreographer William Forsythe returns with the U.S. premiere of a new work based on the rhythms of Elizabethan tragedy, October 9th to 12th. Tickets and preview at BAM.org.
Saturday afternoons on WNYC. Smart, thought-provoking, engaging.
So, okay, why does a kid like Jonathan Perez get himself arrested on purpose by Border Patrol?
Xavier, you work in fashion?
Yep.
So how would you describe your fashion sense?
Brooklyn-ish.
Brooklyn-ish.
Passive-aggressive.
Passive-aggressive.
Join us Saturday afternoons on 93.9 FM.
Mark Bittman and Jamie Oliver are among the people who have called The Stop amazing and Toronto's food mecca. But when Nick Saul became its executive director back in 1998, it was still a small urban food bank with lots of mislabeled cans and food industry cast-offs full of sugar, fat, and salt. He tells the story of The Stop's transformation from dreary food pantry to thriving community food center in a book called The Stop, How the Fight for Good Food Transformed a Community and Inspired a Movement. It's written with the help of Andrea Curtis and published by Melville House. And I'm very pleased that it brings Nick Saul to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Now, you are no longer at The Stop. You left last year. You are now the president and CEO of Community Food Centers Canada.
That's right. We're trying to scale some of the learnings at The Stop over lots of years across the country.
And is that a government agency, or is that just an offshoot of what you did at The Stop?
Yeah, it's an offshoot of what we did at The Stop. It's an NGO, and we're pushing hard to raise the capital to try and build these community food centers across Canada.
Where is The Stop?
Stop is in downtown Toronto, very low-income, culturally diverse community. And as you said, I started there in 1998 running what everyone calls a food pantry, and we tried to turn it around, and we were successful in that.
It's a former industrial area?
That's right. A lot of manufacturing jobs used to be in the neighborhood, and as we turned to a service economy, those jobs disappeared and more vulnerable ones took their place. Also a community where lots of new immigrants coming to the city set up shop. The housing relative to other parts of the city was a bit more affordable.
You write that while food banks seem like a staple these days, they only became a widespread phenomenon in North America during the recession of the early 1980s, and many were built to be only temporary. I'm surprised to hear that it was even necessary in Canada, which I've always thought of as being more of a welfare state than the United States.
Oh, boy. I mean, I've been in the States the last little bit, and there is this misconception about Canada being the land of milk and honey. And
I didn't say the land of milk and honey.
No, but
I've been there. It's cold.
Yeah, well, it is cold. But there's also quite a bit of poverty and a serious problem around the gap between rich and poor. It's growing exponentially here. So about 12 to 15% of our population is food insecure, meaning they're not sure where they're going to get their next meal, or they're missing meals so their kids can eat. So we have significant difficulties here, and as you mentioned, in the 1980s, food banks started to proliferate both in Canada and North America, and I think there was a sense that these would be temporary and they'd be shut down once the economy returned, and in fact, the right to food, which both Canada and the U.S. Adhere to, would maybe go back toward government to start to deal with the problem, but that never happened.
We have
thousands of them.
How have food banks like the Stop been funded, and where does the food come from?
Well, most of the food banks or food pantries in the U.S. and Canada are funded by a whole range of means. At the Stop, it was everything from direct mail and individual donors to doing events to corporations to trade unions to a bit of government. But the fact is, most food banks and food pantries don't have a lot of resources. They're largely volunteer-run and they are under-resourced and ephemeral and have not a lot of energy to do anything more than taking food off a truck, putting it on a shelf, and then handing it to very desperate people. And the food itself is not healthy at all. Most of it are kind of consists of corporate cast-offs that the fat, sugar, and salts you referred to, failed market food experiments. And there's an increasing, I mean, there is a push on to get more and more produce and better food, but it continues to be a problem. A lot of it is processed. And in low-income communities, that's a healthcare crisis on a plate, as those communities are disproportionately affected by issues like diabetes and obesity and heart disease. So it is a significant problem.
So the companies that are donating these things are getting rid of stuff and then are able to also get a tax write-off.
Yeah, they can. There's no tax write-off here in Canada, but in the States and in some regions that's the case. And also there's a lot of corporate glow for doing that. And as governments back off meeting people's basic human needs, people run toward private food charity, and I can't imagine there are many people listening to the show who think that private food charity is the answer to hunger in North America.
You had previously worked at a homeless shelter. Did that lead you to work at the Stop?
No, it's funny. I really didn't know what I was getting myself into when I took the job at the Stop. I've done many years of work in low-income communities, organizing tenants in public housing to take greater control over their housing. I worked with homeless guys in the east end of Toronto who were sleeping rough outside and supported them to get into transitional housing and then into affordable housing. So the food file was new to me, and quite frankly, I knew very little about food, and I also knew that the food bank was not an adequate response to what was going on in the neighborhood that I arrived in. So we simply, in those early days, just listened to people, and they were pretty clear that they wanted to be cooks and gardeners and engaged citizens and volunteers, and they simply didn't want to line up, get to the front of the line, and be handed a not very healthy hamper of food. So that was the start of how we started to reimagine our organization into this place where food is about health and hope and skills and sustainability and greater equity.
Well, you write about how uncomfortable it was for you to just simply hand out that food with very little exchange, but also that it was hard to enforce the food bank's qualification system.
Well, I mean, I think that we just wanted to be a place where, regardless of why you showed up the door, we would be able to help you out. And in those early days, there were a lot of people who would show up, and there was kind of chaotic system as to who got food, who didn't get food, and
you have to turn people away?
Oh, yeah. I mean, food banks are constantly having trouble meeting the need that's walking through the door. And as I mentioned, they're extraordinarily under-resourced. So, and then sometimes volunteers go on holiday and food banks close. So they're not a very adequate response to the high level of stress and marginalization that exists in far too many of our communities.
Well, although your parents are from Toronto, didn't you spend much of your childhood in Africa? You
say
that your time spent on food ration lines in Mozambique also had a big influence on you.
Yeah, I was born in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and then I lived in Mozambique for a while as well. And one of the things I was responsible for in Mozambique was to get the rationed bread and milk. And standing in line, I tell you, it's like being in a, when people slow down and look at a car accident, it isn't very dignified. And so that was one of the first things that we worked at very hard at the Stop, to say no more lineups. So for example, in our community meal programs, it's all table service, and of course the food is, we really focus on healthy food, given that for many people that will be the first or the only good meal they eat that day. So the lineup to me, there's no problem with lining up at a bank or at a sporting event, but when you have to line up for a basic need, I don't think there's anything more embarrassing or humiliating than that. And most of the research suggests that as many people stay away from food pantries as go to them because of the embarrassment associated with it.
When did you start planting your own gardens, and who was doing the planting? Were the people who were coming to the food bank to get those awful cans of food?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, I think that the food pantry is based on this idea of a transaction. You stand in line, you get to the front of the line, you get handed food, and you go home. And we wanted to start to build relationships. And, of course, food is a beautiful way to do that. Through it, you can connect with people and you can express your background and culture. Eat good food, you're healthy, and if you grow it sustainably, it's good for the planet. And, of course, if everyone has access to good food, you have a safer and healthier neighborhood. So we started to build programming that was more participatory and less stigmatizing, like the community gardens and our cooking groups. And those are areas where you can start to erase that us versus them and giver taker that is part of the food bank transaction. And our gardens were places where people could find themselves and find their voice really on issues that mattered most to them, like, you know, a Bangladeshi fellow who arrives in the city and is kind of isolated and alone, and he gets involved in our gardens and he learns what he can grow in this climate and take it back to his windowsill or backyard. So ostensibly our programs are there around food, but really food is this powerful way to connect, and that's what we kind of exemplify through our food programming.
It also leads to cultural exchanges. So if you have immigrants from Afghanistan, Brazil, China, Pakistan, they're going to learn how to cultivate American crops, but also introduce people to some of the things from their homelands.
That's right. I mean, food is that glorious thing that we all have really interesting cultural food practices, and we run a program called the Global Roots Initiative at the Stop, and it's a chance for cultures from around the world to grow in small plots what they would grow back home, and then share it with each other. And I can't say it enough that food is about pleasure and joy and connection and health. And too often when we think of low-income communities, we don't think of those things at all. And so, we really believe in this new community food center movement that we're pushing, that we have to create organizations that reflect the future we want to see, which are, healthier and fairer and more inclusive. And there's a large political aim to our work to ensure that, people aren't hungry because there isn't enough food out there. People are hungry because of low minimum wages, expensive health care, unaffordable housing, pensions that don't cover the bill. There's a whole host of reasons why. It's not because people are poor budgeters or they're poor because it's a character flaw. No, these are structural reasons. And we want to create centers that not only meet people where they're at with really good, healthy food, but also get them involved about talking about these larger issues that are driving vulnerability in the first place.
Getting them engaged in political activity. When did you introduce Healthy Beginnings? Was that soon after you started making the changes?
In fact, that was one of the programs that existed pre-me coming in 1998, but it was seen as an adjunct to the organization. And I really felt it was kind of ground zero for building this kind of relationship that I was talking about, because our perinatal health program called Healthy Beginnings brings moms together who are, don't have a lot of resources, and anyone who's been through a pregnancy knows that it's a very stressful time, and we had a huge problem around low birth weights in our neighborhood. So we created this initiative that allowed moms to come in, have a good meal, to get help from the public health nurses, and to really start to connect with their neighborhood and understand what resources existed out there to help them through this very difficult time. And I'm happy to say that program spawned programs across the country and has had an enormous impact on ensuring babies are healthy when they're born in our neighborhood.
Do you also teach these women about nutrition beyond their pregnancies?
Sure. I think that, the main thing I would say is that low-income folks know what good food is. It's fruits and vegetables, it's lean meats, it's good dairy, but it's just unaffordable. So our cooking groups and our nutrition programs are important, but that's certainly not why people are poor. But we all need, I find that in an era when the more cooking shows there are on TV, the less we seem to know about cooking, that we need to create space where people are learning together, and we certainly do that in abundance in all the community food centers that we're building out across Canada.
You write that 44% of the adults and 36% of the children who use your facilities still go hungry at least once a week. And you say that 90% of the people who use food banks still have to go into debt just to buy food or other necessities. So how would you change that?
Well, I think first and foremost, we need to ask some very honest and frank questions about the food banking system that's been built in both our countries over the last 30 years. Do they reduce hunger? Do they improve health? Do they create pathways out of poverty? And the answer to most of those questions is no. Do they divide us as citizens? Do they create embarrassment and stigma? Do they let government and all of us off the hook? Because we can kind of point to them and say, oh, the problem's being taken care of. And that's not the case in all three of those issues.
So, in this country, there are many people who resent food stamps because they feel that they are working hard for other people to live off the dole.
Yeah, well, I don't buy that for a minute. I mean, there is a lot of finger-pointing that happens at poor people, and I've worked for 20 years in low-income communities, and I've never found someone who wanted to live in a dingy, moldy basement apartment or put cockroach traps around their kids' cribs so that the kid can have an uninterrupted sleep or send their kid to school hungry. So, people have dreams and hopes, and they want good jobs, and they want safe communities, and so I really push back on that notion that people simply want to be on the dole. There is no style or life when you're living poor. There's one thing to have the golden handcuffs when it comes to a job that pays you really well and great benefits, but there's no golden handcuffs when you're living on welfare or on food stamps, I'll tell you that.
So are places like The Stop just a stopgap approach to a bigger problem?
Well, I hope that that's not been what's communicated. I think they are places where people can come in, feel dignified and respected, and start to put their lives back together again, and also be involved, we hope, in the political questions that should be asked around why people are poor. So we feel we're building organizations that are clearly supporting people when they need it most, and not always when they hit rock bottom. We're about trying to prevent people from hitting rock bottom, and I think that has enormous societal impact positively. So our organizations, yes, they're NGOs, but they're a place where people can start to put their lives back together again. And, you know, there's countless stories of that. And the book that I've written with my wife is told through stories. And, you know, take a guy like Glenn, for example, who had a really rough childhood, was an alcoholic for a while, beat that, built a business, the economy wiped it out. He ended up working a minimum wage job at a terrible place and even lost that. And he ended up in our center, and he came in and he had a great meal. He looked up, became a volunteer. We hired him part-time, got a full-time job. And just as we were writing the finishing touches on the book, I saw him getting off a streetcar, a tram, and he had just come from a program where he was learning about photography because he wanted to be a photographer when he retired. So those are the kind of stories that are all over the place in centers that are healthy and dignified and create space for people to do good things, because everyone wants to move on and realize what hopes they have.
You have won the Jane Jacobs Prize and the Queen's Jubilee Medal. How are you handling your celebrity?
There is no celebrity. I cook dinner at 6. I have tons of work to do. I work with great colleagues. And, I'm afraid celebrity is not chasing me.
The Stop, How the Fight for Good Food Transformed a Community and Inspired a Movement, is published by... who's publishing this?
Melville.
Melville Press.
House. They're awesome in Brooklyn.
And written by Nick Saul and his wife, Andrea Curtis. Thank you for being on our show today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.